Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Rob Blevins, who's the executive director of the Discovery Center of Springfield. Thanks for stopping by, Rob.
Dave, I'm so happy to be here and to do some web exclusives for everyone.
There you go. Now, of course, the first thing I want to know is, why does the Discovery Center exist? So talk about your reason for existence.
That's a great question. I ask myself that every single day. I'm kidding, of course. There is a resounding answer to that, and that's because it's necessary. It's vital to the Ozarks as a region. I've talked to people about the size of our city and whether or not we deserve to have a science center. A lot of big cities have them, and a lot of cities our size do not have them. But not only do we deserve it, we need it. We have incredible growth in STEM careers. Governor Mike Parson, who is at the Discovery Center, speaking with us for a press conference just a couple weeks ago, he had said that the jobs that the kids in the room that day with us, you know, the jobs that they're going to haven't even been created yet. We don't even know what we need to know yet. And so to have something like the Discovery Center that's able to get kids excited about learning, I think is vital and necessary to our economic growth, because our STEM jobs, they grew by 28% in the city of Springfield last year. And the kids' interest, or the people graduating college or ready for a STEM job, they did not grow by 28% last year. And beyond that, so not everybody's going to go into a STEM career that comes into the Discovery Center. So we do that inspiring piece.
On a related note, you know, I go out into the schools a lot and talk to people, and I would say from my own experience, I'm not sure that the interest in STEM is going up at all, but in fact, might be going down a little bit in the school systems from some of the things I've seen. Have you noticed anything like that?
You know, I wouldn't say that I've seen a huge amount of growth. I don't know that I've seen it go down per se, but we're not I can tell you that it's not double digits increase in STEM interest. Specifically math. I mean, really,
right.
Math is not sexy.
No.
It's
scary. For many, many people, mm-hmm. for example, going into physics, which has great job opportunities, but of course we have many fewer majors than, for example, bio. And when you talk to people about it, it seems ridiculous, but the number one impediment is that they ask how much math is going to be involved.
And that's cultural. And it's something that, whether you're doing it intentionally as a parent or a teacher, we do, and we make it scary, and we don't let it be fun, and we don't often apply it to life and talk about why math is important and how everybody – I don't think anybody is bad at math. They're not born bad at math.
Right.
I think that anybody can learn it.
Yes.
They just need to be taught the right way. And so that's part of what we do at the Discovery Center, is that we'll make math fun. We have some lessons that we do with Legos, for instance, that teach math. And kids don't even know that they're learning math.
Right.
But then they do. And then they realize, and maybe not that day, maybe it's later in life, that they realize that, hey, that's when I learned that I was good at math, that I could be good at math. And then that tool, that one piece that they were missing to be able to be the thing that they wanted to be more than anything else, they have that now.
So talk about the fact that this is your 20th anniversary. I mean, that's a big deal. I know that sustaining something is much more difficult than creating something. So discuss that.
Well, sustaining something is much more difficult than creating it. So some days, I remember when I realized that it was going to be our 20th anniversary when I started, and I saw the date and was like, oh man, we've 20 years. And so we did a bunch of research and started getting ready for that celebration. And one of the feelings that hit me was, I'm standing here in this 60,000 square foot museum, and 20 years ago, it didn't exist like this. It didn't. This wing wasn't even here. And to think about how incredible it is that people before me, before us, had made this possible. It's like we inherited this ready-made thing, you know? And so sustaining it is difficult, but I'm so grateful for what has come before, the people that have invested so much time and the resources into what we are. But yeah, no, it's difficult. 60,000 square foot, it is difficult
to
sustain.
When I think of that, to me, the building of this thing to the 60,000 square feet is part of the sustainability. I've been part of a lot of projects where they start off great guns and they're dead after a year. before you have a chance to get 60,000 square feet. So to me, that is part of the whole sustaining mm-hmm. the process. When I say sustain, I don't mean we're just in sustaining mode, but constantly reinventing and building on top of something without it just going belly up, because a lot of projects go belly up.
Yeah, and we had some time in that 20 years where we were, how do we just keep the doors open? How do we keep the electricity on? How do we keep heating this thing? Our utility bill every month, especially during the winter or the hot months, we're talking about $10,000, $12,000
sure.
just to do that. And that's a lot of money. That's over $100,000 a year that we ship out just to keep the lights on right. at the Discovery Center. And so it is incredibly difficult to just keep the day-to-day operations going. And then to your point, when you get into a mode where you're just worrying about the utilities, how is that sustainable when you're just thinking right. about utilities?
Right.
You got to make time to think about how are we going to get kids excited in this decade with relevant stuff. And so right. we're in verbal contract with a company here in town to create a technology lab on our phenomena floor, where we're going to have our exploratory lab there is going to turn into a computer lab, and mm-hmm. we'll have 30 Chromebooks, and we're going to have big TVs that we can instruct and teach computer programming on. We'll have our 3D printers out, and we'll have robotics, and we'll be starting to talk about that, and maybe even drones. And then we'll also have the pinnacle of this entire thing is that we're going to have two omnidirectional VR units, where you're on a slide mill. So it's not a traditional omnidirectional treadmill like you've seen in the movie Ready Player One, or read about in the book. It is a book too. Mm-hmm. We're going to have those. And so kids are going to – we'll be the first science center in the world to have omnidirectional VR right wow. here in Springfield, wow. Missouri. And so those are the things that we're doing, because what we saw, our teenagers aren't excited about coming to the Discovery Center anymore.
Sure.
They drop off. We need to do things for that.
So you mentioned something that piqued my interest, and we had discussed this ourselves a little bit ago before we started the show. This whole idea of how you engage your own the people that work there and the people that volunteer there in this vision and this effort, and you've tried to inject some sort of business models into that, into training, into so talk about how you're trying to take examples from outside what people would think of as the science world and try to put that into the Discovery Center.
Yeah, that's a great point. We did talk about that. Business. So you mentioned that term, and a lot of people, they do not equate a nonprofit as a business.
Sure.
But it is a corporation.
Yeah.
You're incorporated. You are a business. Whether you like it or not, you're a business. Now, your prime goal every year is not to create
money for
stakeholder,
your stockholders.
Yeah, for shareholder sure. value. You're not trying to increase dividends or anything like that. That's not why we exist. We exist to inspire lifelong love of learning. That is our chief goal every year. But you can't do that if you can't pay those utility bills. And so that is important to worry about those things and take care of those as well. So we actually attended a workshop, our leadership team, this last week, and we are going to be implementing the great game of business that Jack Stack used to turn SRC, Springfield Remanufacturing, into what it is today, which is a highly successful company. If you'd invested $1,000 in SRC back in the 80s, you would now have over $1 million.
Wow.
Like that's the type of return that they've been able to do as a company by playing this thing called the Great Game of Business. And it's teaching financial literacy. It is explaining how everybody has a stake in the outcome and then rewarding your employees for that. And so one of the things we'd like to do through that is focus on our financials to where we can use net revenue and actually end with net revenue. You know, our goal is not going to be to break even anymore. It's going to be
yeah.
that we're going to have money left over each year to do something cool and new in the Discovery Center. And instead of just having a donor's name on that, because you go out and you find somebody who wants
right.
to say like, hey, I want this to be the Rob Blevins whatever in
gizmo.
The center. Yeah,
sure.
Of course, that's what I want, Dave. It's the gizmo. And it'll have all of our staff's name on it. The people
okay.
that, you know, they give their life. When you talk about heroes, people that work in the nonprofit world, they give their life to that mission. And so they should have something that they can bring their grandkids later to in life that they can say, like, hey, when I worked at the Discovery Center, we helped build this because we were careful with how we spent money and we were ambitious with how we raised money. And we worked hard for this, and here it is.
Now, I mean, other nonprofits have similar kinds of circumstances. I've read a lot about symphony orchestras, especially in smaller mm-hmm. markets, that struggle with this sort of thing, how to keep people engaged and so forth. Now, you and I discussed what kind of cash flow you want, and you talked about the people that actually walk through the door to come to the Discovery Center and pay to get in as opposed to just grant money and so forth. And so is part of this effort so that you make the Discovery Center a more exciting place so that people want to come through the door? Or off the street? Is that part of it?
Yeah, twofold. Yes. We want our museum to be completely sustainable based on the people that are interested in sustaining it by coming through the door, by checking out the Sioux Science Day that we have, or getting a membership for a year-long pass to the Discovery Center. That sort of revenue is the type of thing that we want to use to sustain us. And then the second part of that is, when we have more people coming through the door, our mission is amplified, our impact, all those things. It's not only the right thing to do for our mission, it's the right thing to do to keep our mission going. So it kind of it's two part in that respect. But yeah, no, we need to make it exciting again to come to the Discovery Center. We've been around 20 years and we're not as shiny as we used to be. There are two types of reviews we get online on Google or on Facebook. And it's those that know we're a nonprofit and those that don't. The right. ones that don't know we're a nonprofit, you will frequently see a one-star or zero-star review saying the carpet's torn right. up and sure. you need to paint and you need to, yes, we know all these things, but we're charging you less than it takes us to operate the museum to come into the Discovery Center. And so they either have a great time or a terrible time. And if they know that we're a nonprofit, then they see the hard work and the value that, you know, instead of buying new carpet, we've kept the prices down so that you can actually afford to come in here.
So now talk about something we discussed, which is the difference, as you see it, between a partnership and a relationship, and then how that plays into the vision that you can have for the future.
Yeah, well, they're spelled differently.
Well, fair enough.
That's a starting point on that. But the difference between a partnership and a relationship. So when you have a partnership, it feels more contractual. That's how they feel different. When you have a relationship, it's less contractual, although in a marriage, there's usually a contract behind all that too. But that's the less exciting part of it, and so we don't feel in that way. So there could be an underlying contract as part of relationship. But when you have a relationship, it goes both ways, and you want the other side to succeed, and you truly and authentically believe in what they do and what you're going to do together. And you treat each other, and the actions start flowing through in a way where you can tell that it's authentic and that you care about each other and you want each other to succeed.
How long will it take to truly build a relationship? So, I mean, we'll talk more about some specific projects. You've had partnerships with a lot of different groups. Does it take active engagement on both sides to slowly turn that into a relationship, or does it just happen? Well, how does that work?
Going back to, so like a real relationship, when did you start dating? When were you actually, you know, boyfriend and girlfriend? And so I think relationships feel that way. They can start out with just a little bit of something that you start doing together. And then before you know it, there's a real relationship there, and it's hard to pinpoint exactly when that happens. Some would argue that the relationship started the moment that you started doing stuff together. And so every relationship will be on its own pace in right. how quickly you want to get involved. And maybe somebody's been hurt in the past with putting themselves out there. And so they have trust issues and right. whether or not they trust this person to become a relationship because they've had too many people that treated them like a partnership. Right. And so you break down some of those barriers. And so it goes through all the same phases of a real relationship.
Is it the executive director's job to nurture the relationships, or do other people take on that role just naturally depending on with whom the relationship is, or how do you work things like that?
Yeah, so every person can only, I believe, sustain so many relationships. And so there is a limit to how many of those that you can have going on. Of course, you can have some less meaningful relationships or friendships that are less time intensive. And so it really is incumbent upon every staff member to develop relationships at the Discovery Center. And so primary relationships, and where they're the person that's primarily sustaining it. And it's kind of like a big, you know, family, you know, married into the family sort of thing. So somebody else might bring a relationship to the table that I have no contact with that organization prior, but I'm like, hey, that's pretty cool group. I'm invested in it. We start communicating outside of just the family gatherings sometimes,
right.
And we, you know, so we all help sustain relationships eventually and encourage those. But often there's a driver.
So when you get around in your group meetings, your team meetings of some sort, maybe upper level or whatever it is, do mm-hmm. people bring things to the table sometimes that other people just say the Discovery Center shouldn't be doing this? How far does it have to get outside what most people would consider the Discovery Center to do? And this will segue right into our next discussion, which is specific projects you might be doing. So do you ever see things that some people inside your group might say, gee, this is really outside our purview? How do you work with that kind of thing?
We do get those things occasionally where we have these requests of our time, and we have to be careful of what we say yes to. For a long time, I feel like we maybe shifted the wrong way with that, where we said no to too much. And so there's science in everything.
Right.
And so it's not a stretch for us to say yes to a lot of stuff. And so instead of saying no, we've tried to figure out, like, well, how can we make this work, and do we have the resources and time available to help make it work?
Great.
And a good example of that would be the Diaper Bank of the Ozarks. You know, like, why is the Discovery Center partnering with the Diaper Bank of the Ozarks?
Right.
A couple of different reasons. First, we believe in their mission too, nonprofit, like-minded hearts. And we're a community – well, I guess a few reasons I should say. We're a community-funded museum. So we have this 60,000-square-foot facility – and we're funded by the community, and so it's not my museum. I take ownership in it, in that I believe in it, and I pour my life into it, but I don't, at the end of the day, I don't own it. The community owns it, and the community owns the Diaper Bank of the Ozarks, and so the community wants them to succeed too, and so we try to partner as often as possible with other nonprofits and helping them succeed. And where the missions overlap, we highlight that, and we pull that out. And so diapers, cloth diapers. They push a cloth diaper education program. And so one of the top items in landfills,
sure,
diapers. We don't want that. That's part of our mission too, is that we don't want the landfills being filled up with diapers. And so we push cloth diapers, and we help them amplify their message and their mission. And so we find those intersections where they can relate. And so
now you guys have a specific project coming up right now that you're working on that's pretty exciting. Has to do with some money from the government somehow. So talk a little bit about that whole effort.
So essentially how this works is that the state of Missouri is forgiving some tax liabilities, $500,000. They'll forgive about $250,000 in tax liabilities, but it's about $500,000 project. And so it's through the NAP program, which is the Missouri Department of Economic Development oversees that. It's the Neighborhood Assistance Program. And so a donor will buy these credits from us, and they have to have business income, and that's where the tax liabilities come from, and on the business side. And they can have 50% of whatever they donate to us forgiven through their NAP credits that they purchased. So if they gave us $1,000, then $500 immediately comes off their tax liabilities to the state of Missouri for their business income. And then they get to deduct it a couple more times, federal and state, as a charitable contribution as well. And so they get that taken off. And so at the end of the day, they are investing out of pocket about 38%, somewhere around there, depending on – always talk to your accountant, not me, when it comes to determining tax liabilities. But about 30% out of pocket. And so they get to do this amazing gift at $1,000. And it's only costing them $380 out of pocket. And so then that gift, it goes to support a program. And the program that we came up with, 3-year program, it's called STEM and Opioid Education for All. And what we're going to do with it is we're going to take these STEM lessons and opioid lessons and take them out into the community and specifically try to target some underserved populations and provide them with a STEM lesson and how opioids work. And we're going to track outcomes, of course. We want to find out how the program is working. But we want to, you know, highlight the dangers of opioid misuse,
right.
And then also get kids inspired with some of our STEM lessons. So it'll feel fun.
So two things that come to mind for me would be, first of all, are you creating the material that goes with the program, and who are your relationship partners that you're creating it with. And then the second thing is, how do you assess? We worry about this a lot because assessment's a big part. And sometimes you're supposed to disconnect the assessment piece from the people who are actually delivering the program so that it's as unbiased as possible. So talk a little bit about those two things.
Yeah. So we in the testing part, I'll address that first. We are going to test our outcomes. And so we do a pretest and a post-test. And the pretest is going to assess their scientific knowledge on the subject that we're going to teach beforehand, and then also their knowledge of opioids, how they work and whatnot. It's going to be age specific too, because we are going to be taking this into senior centers, and we're going to be taking it into preschools. Two of the biggest areas, the front of life and the back of life, where we don't focus much on STEM education, and it's very important. Both are very important for the opioid side of this. So we're going to do that pretest and then the post-test, and then measure what the difference is between those to see if we've been successful in teaching the things that we were aiming to teach. And it's going to be done electronically. And okay. So they're going to actually get the pretest before we even arrive. Their teacher's going to administer that. And then the post-test, if they come on a field trip and then do it, they'll do it on site with us. But elsewise, it'll be done without us even in the room. And we'll just collect that information and that data. And it is what it is at that point. You know, of course, we'll adjust and try to do a better job if we're not meeting our goals for that. And then on the relationship or partner side, we're not the number one expert in probably anything. You know, that's not what the Discovery Center is supposed to be about. We're supposed to have a little bit of everything. We're the Baskin Robbins. We've got all the flavors.
Sure.
But I don't know how we make orange. Of course, as the executive director, I don't know how we make orange.
Equating orange with opioids is maybe a dangerous thing.
That might be a dangerous thing. I need to add that into the lesson plan, actually. Don't equate orange to opioids. But we do have some experts in the community. We are a healthcare community. We have Cox and Mercy, and we're going to rely on them to help us. And Cox has even talked about helping us by sending in some opioid experts, like a pharmacist, people like that, to come in and help with these lessons so that we have that there as well. And then we're also talking about, you know, getting all those stakeholders, Borough Health, the Springfield Greene County Health Department, getting them involved, dynamic DNA, even talking about like the ability to test people for how they react to different medicines. Because there's differences, and we're going to get into all of that age dependent, of course, in those lessons. And so having all those people come together to help us get really good material that we can teach how opioids work. And we're going to have an exhibit in the center too. Mm-hmm. An opioid exhibit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating, right?
But not hands-on.
It'll be hands-on, but not with the medicine. We're not going to hand out opioids and say like, hey, how are you feeling? Let's do a test. who wants to help me today? We have any volunteers. It won't be like that, but maybe talk about receptors and things like that.
Sure.
And Mercy's doing this incredible thing with VR where they're teaching people how to manage their pain, and so maybe we have some VR component
that would be
with
a good idea. Sure.
And definitely in our laboratory, we have a state-of-the-art lab in our facility, and so we can teach some really cool stuff there. And so maybe we get into measuring medications based on weight, or, you know, we have a lot to figure out still how we're going to tweak this and really make this exhibit come to life and speak. But it's going to be something that's fun and hands-on.
Great. Well, you know, Rob, amazingly enough, we've covered quite a bit of ground and we're going to have to wrap up. I really appreciate you stopping by. Thanks so much for coming.
Yeah, it feels like we covered about 60,000 square feet of ground here in this 15 minutes. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Once again, this is Dave Cornelison signing off for STEM Spots.
This program is a collaboration of the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science and KOTO Telluride.